What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This week's podcast is also brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/mugglecast today for details.
Hey there, MuggleCast listeners. I am back to inform you of some excellent news. GoDaddy.com is having better deals than ever. For only $3.59 a month for 12 months, you can get GoDaddy.com's Economy Package. And with 250 gigs of bandwidth, 5 gigs of storage, and up to 500 email accounts, you can get your own website up and running with success. And as usual, enter code MUGGLE, that's M-U-G-G-L-E, when you check out. Save an additional 10% on any order. Some restrictions apply. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.
All right, welcome to our Beetle the Bard discussion. We just all finished reading the book. A little late compared to how quickly we did our book 7 discussion. Do you remember that, Jamie?
I don't remember that.
When we were in London, once we finished, we all got it.
But we got more listeners when we weren't there.
Right.
That was a success.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. So now we're here. We're all finished reading Beetle the Bard. Jamie, Matt, and I are here in London, and Micah and Laura are here via Skype. Hi, guys and girls.
Hey.
Hey.
So let's go around. Well, first we're going to talk about the news of the week. And there's been so much Beetle the Bard news going around. Micah, you want to take us through that?
Sure. The first piece of news that really kicked off the week was there was an unveiling of an original copy of Beetle the Bard at the New York Public Library. And I think there was another one at the National Library of Scotland, but we'll leave that alone because I didn't go there. I went to the one in New York City, and it was a cool event. They had Arthur Levine there from Scholastic, as well as the president of the New York City Public Library, and they did a short press event and then unveiled the copy of Beetle the Bard that belonged to Arthur Levine, and we got to go and take pictures and ask them questions, and it was a neat little event. But
sounds like a fango.
What's that?
You're a fango, Micah.
Of the original fango. Copy of Beetle the Bard?
Arthur Levine.
No.
Micah, I know you have this in the announcements, but do you want to tell your background poster story real quick? You might as well tell it here since you were there.
Sure. I was taking a picture.
Go ahead. And I'll explain my part.
Well, I can explain your part too.
All right.
It's part of the story. I took a bunch of pictures of the glass case that this book was in, and behind the book, if you look at some of the pictures that are on MuggleNet, you can see that there's this poster in the background of the case, and it details, you know, what Beetle the Bard is, and it also lists all the other books in the Harry Potter series. But if you notice, and as Andrew pointed out when I showed him the picture, that the books are not in sequence. So I think it's Order of the Phoenix actually is the second book in order. And so what happened was...
Well, hold on. The order went Sorcerer's Stone, Order of the Phoenix, Chamber of Secrets, Prisoner of Azkaban, Goblet of Fire, Half-Blood Prince, then Deathly Hallows. Which was weird, and I pointed that out to you. I was like, why is it out of order on that poster? So go ahead.
Right. So I said, well, Scholastic should know about this if they don't already. So I emailed one of the people over there, and she responded to me, and she said, yeah, you know, we knew about this, but we weren't able to fix it and get a reprinted version by the time we did the unveiling, but we'll fix it for when it actually goes on display at the New York Public Library.
Wait. So what are they doing with the one that's messed up?
Well, she said, since you were the first one to point it out, give me your address and I'll send you the poster. Yep.
You can That's eBay good. It.
What's your eBay? I think she just wanted my address.
Hey, hey now. So that's pretty funny. You should have J.K. Rowling sign it and be like, she'll be like, how the hell did you get that?
Yeah.
But that's pretty cool because it was sitting there right in front of the book and sitting there in the library right now. So that's cool.
Yeah, it's a cool story.
Where are you going to put it?
Where am I going to put it?
Yeah, the poster. Where are you going to keep it? You can put it in your bedroom on your ceiling. So like...
stare up at it every night.
Yeah, just before you go to sleep. Along with all your pictures of Arthur Levine.
And then what else is going on, Micah?
I don't know. What else is going on?
Christie's report from London's great. Christie's report from the J.K. Rowling Tea Party. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, she's a staff member of ours. She got a chance to go over to the Tea Party and kind of, speaking of fangirls, act like one and stand outside.
Take pictures
and she seemed to really enjoy herself and was able to report for us that there were a couple of actors and actresses that were at this party as well.
Vanna Lynch.
Mm-hmm.
Who else? A couple other people. A couple of the Harry Potter actors.
Yep. Matthew
and,
Lewis.
Yeah. And one MuggleNet visitor actually just sent in a report from inside the Tea Party because they won the essay contest. And she said it was really fun, and all the kids were really excited to see Joe and all that. So,
since I saw a picture of some of those kids. They did not look like they were elementary school.
Well, the kids look older here, Jamie, don't they? They age differently.
Yeah. it's the water.
Yeah.
No, it's the tea. Oh,
that's what it is.
The tea.
It's the British tea.
It's English morning breakfast.
Yeah.
And what else has been going on, Micah?
Well, you guys are still in London. How'd the show go earlier this week?
Our show was a lot of fun. It was at the Waterstones of Piccadilly Circus. We had, well over 300 people there, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, like 6,000
yeah. people. Yeah. And, yeah, it was a lot of fun. And thank you to everyone who came out and said hello. We hung out with a lot of the people afterwards, and that was a lot of fun. Then everyone got the book.
Maybe we should just apologize to Josh Bolton's parents about our bad.
There's a rumor going around that I insulted a kid by the name of Josh Bolton, who we interact with on Facebook a lot, but I actually did not. I wasn't talking about him for the millionth time. I was talking about someone else who was there.
Sorry, Josh. Sorry, Josh. Okay. On behalf of Andrew.
Whatever. And then one last thing, Micah.
Yeah. Back on Thursday, RDR Books coincidentally withdrew their appeal for the publication of a companion book by Steve Vanderark. And it's just interesting that they did it on December the 4th, the same day that Beetle the Bard came out.
Yeah.
That's a good coincidence. Surely won't give them good press because everyone will be thinking about Beetle the Bard, not about Steve Vanderark's book.
Yeah, but I guess they figure, you know, the fan sites will post it, and while everyone is on the fan sites, it's lame.
But he's still making a book. It's still going to be published. It's just going to have the title of an unauthorized version of
Harry Potter and Beyond or something like that.
Something like that.
Why should you just give it up?
Yeah. Move on to Twilight.
Yeah.
Get on the bandwagon.
Okay. Is that it, Micah? For news?
That's all I got. Yeah.
Yeah. That RDR thing kind of annoys me. And I didn't post it the day it came out because obviously that's what they wanted.
Yeah.
I mean, I waited till the next day, but still. Announcements. MuggleCast won at the 2008 Podcast Awards in the entertainment category. Didn't we talk about that already?
Talked about it on your live show.
No, we didn't.
No, we didn't. No, we haven't talked about
it. Okay, well, thank you, everyone who voted for us in the 2008 Podcast Awards. And that ceremony is actually a couple hours from now. I don't think the show will be out before that, but Micah will be representing us. Thank you, Micah.
No way. Really?
Well, it's all live online. It's like not in person.
So, unlike last year.
Right.
Why aren't they doing it live?
I don't know.
Can't
money?
Afford it,
I don't know. I guess so.
Yeah.
It's the economy.
Yeah.
The economy sucks.
Yeah. We have to use streaming. But that'll be fun. And then also, don't forget that MuggleCast will be at Azkatrash 2009, July 18th to 21st, I think, something like that. We're going to be doing a podcast after the midnight release of Half-Blood Prince. So at like 3 a.m. we're going to be doing a podcast discussing the movie. Everyone's going to be really excited because it just came out. So
are you gonna try Gil Jane?
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, hopefully we'll have money then. So.
Hopefully the economy will be better. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider in spoken word entertainment. Audible has over 35,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded and played back anywhere, just like MuggleCast. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/MuggleCast today to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up. Again, go to audiblepodcast.com/MuggleCast today for your free audiobook. And finally, don't forget to vote for us on Podcast Alley. It's MuggleCast December, so don't forget to vote.
So we won for the 2008 Podcast Awards, so we can say it was MuggleCast 2008.
Sure.
Since you're in England as well, mate.
Yeah, mate. Mate. And then next year will be 2000 mine.
Yeah. So let's move on to our main discussion this week. We're going to be talking all about Beetle the Bard. As I said earlier, we all finished reading it. And let's start off with our general thoughts about the book. Laura, how about you first? What you just finished reading this, I think. What did you think of it?
You know, I was really surprised by how much I enjoyed it. I kind of expected to just get it and think, oh, that's nice, fairy tales. But I really enjoyed Dumbledore's commentaries because he has a very, and Micah and I talked about this, warped sense of humor.
Yeah.
Especially when he talked about Aberforth and his favorite story that his mom used to tell him.
Yeah.
And there were just like a lot of really cool like little things, like when you open the book and it says translated from the ancient runes by Hermione Granger.
Yeah,
that
just
was really
nice
cute.
Little tidbits like that. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Wasn't he kind of arrogant though, Dumbledore? Like when
he was
a bit about the greatest wizards thing and then the footnote, you know, I was expecting something about Hugh the important wizards, and it just said like me.
Yeah, like me.
Same as me.
It was in there twice. There was a really? "as such as myself" thing.
But, yeah, you know, I was like, okay.
That was so funny. Well, Dumbledore kind of is a little cocky that way, don't you think?
Yeah.
Sometimes trying to be clever.
I guess, like, she did it on purpose because, like, he's a flawed character and now all his flaws are coming out more so, you know.
Well, I mean, everyone talks about how he's the greatest wizard of all time, and I think he's just, like, nodding to that fact.
Yeah.
And, like, just, well, ever since everyone says so, I mean, that's me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, Micah, did you get excited at that goat thing?
No.
He's turned to Arthur Levine now. And then he's gone.
He loves Levines.
Goats. No, I agree with Laura. I mean, we talked about it earlier. Just his perverted sense of humor. I wouldn't even call it warped. I would call it perverted with some of the little stories and that he references throughout the course of the book, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But I liked it. You know, I spent more time on the commentary than I did on the actual stories. You know, I agree with what Laura said. I thought it was going to kind of be one of those books that you just get and you're like, oh, it's nice to have.
Yeah.
And just spend a couple minutes looking through it. But the commentary definitely made it, for sure.
Yeah. I really, really enjoyed it, too. I just thought the stories were so nice. And I read this on our way to Oxford the day after – or the day it came out. And it was just so relaxing, you know, sitting there traveling through the suburbs of London and reading this book. And it was really fun. Dumbledore's notes really made it, but I also really, really, really enjoyed the tales too.
Yeah.
More than I thought I would.
I was expecting it to just be a collection of like normal fairy tales mixed with a bit of magic. I wrote a review. This journalist emailed me and asked me to revise a review, but I think I got it to him a bit late. But anyway, I said that I was expecting it to be like Snow White hunched over a cauldron with a wand and stuff, but it wasn't. They were really original and really, really funny. And I thought they taught moral like tales and stuff, moral lessons, which fairy tales should do, really, because that's the definition of a fairy tale, you know. So I think quite a bit of thought went into this book. It wasn't just written, you know, last minute to get it out for charity and stuff. Like, I actually really enjoyed it. I thought it stands alone away from Harry Potter, although obviously all the references to the books and, like, the, you know, translated by Hermione Granger and Dumbledore storyline adds to it for the hardcore fans. I thought it was awesome.
Mm-hmm. I really love the book, actually, a lot. I think The only opinion I probably have, which is kind of a selfish opinion, is that I kind of wanted more stories from it because they were just so good.
I just wanted more.
There was only five. At some point, I looked at how far I was in the book, and I kind of got upset because I read more than half in, like, 15 and a half an hour. But,
Read it twice, Matt, then you get 10 times.
Yeah. or read it backwards, and you get it in what, finish?
That's amazing.
I think Yiddish. I really love the drawings J.K. Rowling drew in the pictures, too. It was just really nice to see, some of the pictures and things that went in on it. Unlike with Harry Potter, where the drawings were at the beginning of each chapter for the U.S. version, but it's just like during the readings, you got to see a little bit of what J.K. Rowling thought, because it's her drawings, so it's like what she envisioned the story was and things. So I thought that was really nice.
She can draw pretty well. Like,
yeah, I was impressed.
It's not bad at all.
All right, let's move on to the main discussion. Micah, would you like to guide us through this, please? Since you developed it ever so wisely.
Yeah. Well, the book opens up and you kind of get a little bit of a background on who Beetle the Bard was, even though it's pretty brief, that he lived in the 15th century and much of his life remains shrouded in mystery. So I think that just kind of set the tone for the book. You don't know a whole lot about this person, which is kind of J.K. Rowling's style, I feel like. He was born in Yorkshire and had an exceptionally luxuriant beard. That kind of reminded me of Dumbledore a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So does the comment after that.
Yeah, but. Sorry, that was me.
I kind of thought it was interesting how J.K. Rowling compares the Fountain of Fair Fortune, She says, the tales are as familiar to many of the students at Hogwarts as Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty are to Muggle non-magical children. And I was thinking, well, do those tales get developed in the movies too? Just like Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty turned into profitable
Disney Cinderella and
films?
Sleeping Beauty in the Muggle world has been like retold like a million times. I mean, we know that the Beetle and the Bard, or the Beetle the Bard books have been redone at least once or twice.
Mm-hmm. It's going to get picked up by Pixar at Disney.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
What did you guys think of, and I know we talked about this a little bit already, but Dumbledore's commentary as a whole, and not only that, but how Rowling felt the need to comment on Dumbledore and what he wrote throughout the course of the book.
I loved his commentary. Some of you guys were saying that it really made the book, and it was really fun to read. And I think it was a great way to get sort of a goodbye to Dumbledore in a way. And I want to talk about this later on when we're talking about his final notes, because I thought there was a lot of meaningful things in those final notes. But they just added so much, and you get a lot of respect for Dumbledore, and it made the book really fun and just enjoyable all around.
I really like the footnotes, too, when he did the notes, like the little things that you went down to see, like the definitions of what this or that meant.
Yeah.
And
they were funny.
I had no idea that Dumbledore's notes be so profound in this book. Like, there's a lot of it.
And, like, they can stand alone as, like, literary criticism.
Yeah.
Like, he's a good writer, like, well, she's a good writer. It actually reads like he knows about books and stuff. But then I think she feels the need to explain, because that's Dumbledore's character. Like, he assumes people know that they're at sort of standard experience level, and he doesn't really think that some people can be complete beginners and stuff, so he'll assume a level of knowledge. So she explains stuff, I guess. But also, he's writing for wizards, and I guess if you're a muggle, then
I was just kind of thinking, wasn't there one point in the introduction where Jo stated that Dumbledore always sort of has a habit of writing a little less than what he knows? And I was just wondering if you guys picked up on anything, like that you felt like he wasn't giving you all the facts?
Didn't Jo say that specifically about the tales of the three brothers?
Yeah, and I'm remembering there was something in there where I read it and I was like, oh, this is what she was talking about, but now I can't remember where it was.
Really? Dumbledore, I'm going to page through it right now. I mean, he talks about the three important items. the Visibility Cloak, the Elder Wand, and the Stone.
When he talks about the Elder Wand, it seems like, yeah, you're right, Laura, that he does kind of hold back on some of the information. Like you think he's going to go somewhere with it, and then he just doesn't really deliver on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, thinking about this book being a success or not, I just thought of something. Since this is so important to Book 7, like, if she'd messed up this book, like, the whole of Book 7 could have, like, not made as much sense or not been as, like, powerful or not. Because if this book read badly, then you'd think, well, basing an entire book on that, the Deathly Hallows and stuff, you know, Dumbledore.
It's lame,
A bit lame. Yeah, so she actually had quite a... She'd undermine her entire Harry Potter series by turning this book into something that people don't really like. So
yeah,
I have to appreciate this.
That's true. Yeah, that's really true. So let's go through the story now. We'll go book by book, or tale by tale.
Or story by story.
Whatever. And the first story was The Wizard and the Hopping Pot. And this one really brought out Joe's cleverness, I thought, because there's a pot that hops, for crying out loud. And what's a brief summary of the story? I mean, basically, this hopping pot is going around making ruckus until the wizard actually starts helping the townspeople, right?
Yeah, it's
like his father used to.
It's the son of this wizard who helps the Muggle village with all their problems.
Until he died.
Until he died. And then the son who was given the pot or the cauldron was... I guess didn't appreciate his father as much and didn't like the cause that he did, and he was just a very bitter person and just refused to do anything. Mm-hmm. So every time one of the Muggle villagers came up and asked for him to solve the problem for him, he denied it, and every time he denied it, it would just come back to him in the pot.
Right.
Yeah, like the curses of in the Bible, you know, when like...
Yeah.
When you got visited by a plague of locusts and stuff, it's warts on a cauldron.
And it would follow him too everywhere he went.
Yeah.
That
had to be a disgusting pot to follow you around with all that disgusting stuff coming out of it.
Yeah. It looks kind of gross.
He was sleeping as well, like
right,
it's like bad milk and cheese and slugs coming out of it.
Yeah, and sour milk.
Yeah, same thing.
Oh yeah. So it was a pretty good story. I think it was a good one to start it off. But let's talk about Dumbledore's notes, because they were pretty interesting, right, Micah?
Yeah. With the wizard going around and eventually helping out all the Muggles in the village, Dumbledore made a note that this particular beetle tale, you know, was somewhat out of step with its time because of the chance of persecution. You know, if you revealed yourself to be a wizard or a witch, you'd often end up being killed. I thought that was, you know, kind of interesting to hear him comment on this story, just because we learned in Deathly Hallows kind of his mentality early on in his life was to sort of have this dominant. You know, him and Grindelwald were sort of, I don't know what the right word is, but they had this practice where they were thinking about dominating the Muggle world, and wizards were the best and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, are fairy tales are they supposed to be in step with their time, so to speak? I mean, you know, the whole not being persecuted for being a wizard, you know, I can't really think of an example where a fairy tale was supposed to abide by all the laws that were going on in that current time.
Well, were the Grimm brothers during their time when they wrote their fairy tales?
I don't know. Never read any of them. Have you, Jamie?
Oh, I haven't read the original. No, I mean,
I think it was even I don't think it was of their time either. When they wrote it, so it was close to what, like the Middle Ages when?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, the original. But then, like, they got translated so many times. I bet they bear no resemblance to what we read today and stuff. You know?
Well, everything is a little more lighter than the original version. So it was probably watered down, and Disney-fied.
Yeah.
Disney-fied.
We also get the nearly headless Nick connection.
Yeah. We learn a little bit of backstory.
Nice. Yeah. It's quite political, this stuff, really, as well. Like, you know, it's just... She just wants to give a history of the world, like, in a wizarding sense. You know what I mean? Like, she wants to teach people lessons and show people how, like, you should accept everyone and stuff. It's just, it's really moral, this book. It's really, really moral. Mm-hmm. I think she's going to run for, like, prime minister or something, too.
I don't think she has a chance.
No, I don't think she
does. Do you?
No, it's just
too nobody, nice. Nobody would vote for
her own autobiography.
That's sort of like Oprah running for president.
Yeah.
I mean, like, she has the popularity vote, but some people would be skeptical, sort of. What else, Micah?
Well, we also learned that there's a revised version of this story that's extremely anti-Muggle and promoted by the likes of a Malfoy. And there's no surprise there. I don't think that an anti-Muggle version of this story would be promoted by somebody in that family.
Yeah. Is this the one – Oh, this is not the one with the – that's the next story. Never mind. The Lucius Malfoy connection that Dumbledore makes I thought was really interesting too.
That was pretty funny.
Yeah. We'll talk about that later.
And I think Jamie mentioned, or was it you, Andrew, earlier about how Dumbledore starts referring him to himself as a brilliant wizard?
Yeah, such as myself. He says
a little
that,
arrogant.
Yeah. He says that here, and then he says it in another story.
It really is so arrogant.
Yeah, it is.
Although, I guess...
I thought it was funny.
It's point out that, at least in the context of the book, these were his private notes.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
He'd been taking, so he probably didn't know.
Doesn't it seem even cockier, though, when he's writing... about himself to himself.
Yeah.
Like he has to remind himself that he's amazing. Such as myself, you attractive young man. But I think with him, like, I don't think it's arrogance. He just tries to give emotion out of stuff because power and emotion is like messed him up in the past. So he just, I think he just keeps the fact and like he thinks he's a pretty good wizard and everyone else does. So he's just like accepting it rather than trying to be, you know. Modest about it, yeah.
There's a couple times during the series, too, though, that he'll refer to himself as being, you know, overly brilliant.
Yeah, it was in Sorcerer's Stone when he said that. I was like, that was one of my more brilliant ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's saying something.
And, like, and in, was it Deathly Hallows when they're, he picks Harry up, no, sorry, Half-Blood Prince, and they're walking along, and, he says to him, Harry, I don't think you'll be attacked tonight. And Harry's like, why? And he's like, deal with me.
Oh, right.
Thanks.
It was sort of like a bittersweet moment.
Yeah.
We get introduced to a character that comes up a couple times throughout this book, Beatrix Bloxham. And she's kind of the anti-version of fairy tales, it seems like. And she tries to recreate them so that they're these pure stories that don't have any sort of real-world application to them. And what it reminded me of, and I actually had this in the notes that I took, but somebody sent in an email, was I thought Rowling was going directly at Laura Mallory when she created this character because of the way that she's described.
Let's read the email. It's from Stephen. Says, I finished reading Beetle the Bard yesterday. I thought it was great. J.K. Rowling did an excellent job as always. I was wondering if any of you thought, like I did when reading Dumbledore's notes on The Wizard and the Hopping Pot, that J.K.R. was poking fun at Laura Mallory. I was speaking specifically about page 17 in the UK version, which reads, we know what it says. When I read this, I almost thought it was like an inside joke. While it would still be funny to the casual reader, those of us who found all things Potter would have something extra to laugh at. The icing on the cake is that our favorite idiot of the year would never know that JKR is making fun of her because she'll probably never read the book.
Mm.
Laura, given that you live in the same state as Laura Mallory, what do you think? You think there's a connection?
I don't think it's a specific connection because also when I read this, I thought of Umbridge.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And how she was constantly trying to sort of change what everybody was thinking and protect the minds of young wizards. I think it's just meant more to sort of poke fun at people who are pro censorship and who want to alter certain
like Laura
things.
Mallory.
So. Yes, like Laura Mallory, but I don't think it's specific.
Do you think
I mean,
Laura
she could have
Mallory,
been thinking of her.
Do you think Laura Mallory would approve or disapprove of this book?
Oh, I think she would approve of the rewritten version of The Hobbit Pot.
Maybe if
I mean,
she
it's
saw
very,
that.
What? It's I mean, it's very, you know, like, I mean, if you listen to this, and we listened and huggled The Hoppity Pot, like,
yeah.
Ew, I think she'd love it.
It's insulting to children as well. Like, it treats them, yeah. You know, it's really patronizing, that revised story.
Yeah. And then next is The Fountain of Fair Fortune, where there's the three witches and the knight, I think it was. It was a knight, right?
Yeah, it was the three mm-hmm. witches and the knight.
And yeah. they have a journey to this fountain. Whoever bathes in it will have fortune for so is the rest, of, the, what, rest
yeah,
of their life.
Good fortune for their entire life.
Mm-hmm. And this seems to be one of the general favorites of the book, correct, guys?
Yeah, it was my
yeah,
favorite.
Jamie, do you know whose favorite it was, actually?
Who's Arthur Levine's?
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's your favorite, too, Mike.
No, actually, it's not my favorite, but...
There's, he read this one online on Scholastic's website, didn't he? There's a video of him reading this?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure there was.
Yeah.
And, so, this was a good one.
Yeah, I really yeah. liked it. It seemed more like a, like more of a broader, I would say almost like a bigger budget if it was a film kind of story. Yeah.
It was more detailed.
Yeah, it was more of a journey.
Extremely moral as well. Like it was.
Yeah,
she was obviously trying to show you know the journey is more important. As Dumbledore said, oh sorry, as Joe says in the beginning, that the journey is more important than the.
Mm-hmm. There's just so much involved in the story too. Yeah. Well, in the story, this garden opens on summer solstice when the day is the longest, and on this day, the garden picks one person with a lot of problems in their life, and they're allowed to bathe in the fountain, and all their troubles would go away. And this story in particular, three witches who all caught pity on each other, like band together and became like a little team to see if one of them were chosen, they would all three go in and help each other. And so on that day, one of the witches was picked and they all grabbed onto each other. And the last witch that was grabbed on was actually entangled in a knight's armor and he was dragged into it too. But my question when that I found kind of interesting was that the creepers, quote unquote, which are like these little vines that grow up on like buildings and things. It caught the first witch and did that mean that the garden only wanted that one witch, or was the garden aware of the truce between all the witches? Because we know at the end of the story that the fountain really had no fortune at all.
But to be fair, like fair fortune is basically chance. So like it could just have come out and they just managed to like catch on to
right.
it.
But what I mean was the fountain had no special ability actually at all.
Yeah, it was just like a water.
Mm-hmm. There was no enchantment.
Water cooler.
Yeah, it was just some nice little
water
cat drinking
It was kind of disappointing, though. Why didn't it actually have fair fortune? Because, I mean, these are fairy tales. It could easily have something like that. So why not?
Well, it's the moral of the story. Well,
yeah, I think it's the moral of the story is that you have the power to solve your own problems.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And this is one that this question I thought was kind of interesting when I was reading it, but didn't you guys think that this story had a good connection to Goblet of Fire in the maze? Like, because with all the things that you had to pass through
mm-hmm.
in order to get to, you know, the trophy, the thing that you're looking for?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I kind of thought this probably was like the story that they thought would probably be a good object to do in the Triwizard Tournament.
And that's quite an interesting point, yeah. Especially since the, you know, Tale of the Three Brothers featured so heavily in Book 7. I wouldn't be surprised if, like... Because Joe just likes to add stuff in that some people will see and some people won't. You know, there are so many layers. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if it was that.
Yeah.
Well, and also there's four champions, just like in the Goblet of Fire. And the last one wasn't even supposed to be part of the journey.
Oh yeah. You're brilliant.
Oh God. Trees take a moment silence.
Well, not to mention it's sort of the same, but like opposite. Like in this story, it's three witches and a wizard, but then in Goblet of Fire, it's three wizards and a witch that are in the maze.
Oh yeah. But the knight's not even. He's a muggle. The knight's a muggle in this story.
Oh, he is a knight. That's interesting.
Matt sort of brought up a good point in this story. I don't think if anyone heard it, the knight is the odd one out, and he wins. And in Goblet of Fire, Harry was the odd one out, and he wins.
Yeah.
It's also about cooperation as well, like magical and non-magical cooperation, you know, and that people can work together.
And he was the humblest of the four, too. He's the one who gave up and let the witches win.
Yeah. Yep. All right, moving along.
Yeah, we don't really have to say the third one, because we kind of already talked about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Micah.
Well, I was looking at the sketch of the fountain, which is on page 34 in the U.S. edition of it. And what I thought was interesting is it has the Deathly Hallows symbol on the lowest bowl. If you look at it, I don't know what page it is in the U.K.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it also looks like the main base that's holding it together is a snake with some sort of wings on it.
Yeah, it almost looks, I think it may be a dragon.
It looks like a dragon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I noticed that, the Deathly Hallows symbol too. What does that mean? Could that mean anything though? I didn't realize what was going on with that.
What are the other two symbols?
It's an eye.
One of them is a rune, but I don't know what it means.
I think it's a Freemason conspiracy.
Well, and then there's that number four. on the third level.
Dan Brown.
I was just like, is this the Da Vinci Code? Wow. It just must be a bunch of symbols that she just uses.
What? She's just like a bigger mix.
This is just the key to some bigger thing that nobody knows about.
Maybe if we decode this, it's like Harry Potter book 8, 2010. Exactly.
Yeah.
If we decode it, she'll write book 8.
Right.
If those two teamed up, damn right.
Someone should start a rumor.
Yeah.
It would be kind of cool if there was like a hidden puzzle in there. It's like a little game in the book. Mm-hmm. Figure out. It doesn't even have to relate to the story. All right. What's next?
Well, Dumbledore spends a lot of times in his notes on this story talking about the pantomime, and I guess that's a British term because, Andrew, you said that this actually doesn't show up in the UK edition.
Yeah.
The footnote doesn't show up in the UK edition about what a pantomime is.
Yeah, what does the footnote say for those of us who have the UK books right now and can't even see it?
Yeah, let me see.
No, I'm trying to find it.
Yeah.
It starts off with, like, UK muggles may not be aware of.
It says, non-British muggles may be unfamiliar with the British tradition of plays presented at Christmas time, usually based on fairy tales and including music, comical characters, and an audience generally of the vigorous type described here.
Mm. That's interesting.
Yeah.
It's probably like the one difference between the books.
See those, yeah.
But what's
it's just another example that once again, Scholastic things are stupid and can't understand certain things.
Yeah,
like apparently Americans don't know what philosophers are. So
yeah, that's true.
Sorcerer's
Stone
cheapening as well. Just to go back to that point, because you know, Sorcerer's Stone is just ridiculous. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's such a stupid title.
To be honest, I didn't know what a pantomime is.
Yeah, but I think you could figure it out though.
Yeah, if you really cared enough.
It's called a dictionary if you don't know. Like
a thesaurus.
We do have those here.
Yeah.
Or an internet.
Internet.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
a World Wide Web.
Plus, if you go through this book, there's plenty of other things you'll see that you don't know what they are.
Yeah.
Even, I mean, like, you know, like, there's no explanation of a charlatan, which was the guy in Cackling Stump, but, you know, there's no explanation of that. So.
Well,
I didn't know what it was. I'll be honest. I never heard the word before.
What is it?
It's a person.
Like a it's just like a faker, isn't it? A joker he flaunts about.
Yeah.
Well, why'd they just put that in the book, like a side note saying, for those of you who don't know what a charlatan is?
CWB's The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
When's the night always darkest, Matt?
The night is all the darkest before the dawn. And the dawn is coming.
That's coming out on DVD soon.
Go buy it on Blu-ray and DVD.
And then we also heard a couple new characters. Professor Herbert Beery of Herbology and Professor Sylvanus Kettleburn of Care of Magical Creatures. That was kind of cool.
I thought this was the only kind of like digression in this book. I thought it was kind of pointless, to be honest.
Yeah, it was. It felt like filler to me.
Yeah, it did. It seemed like filler.
I thought it was the first look into Hogwarts we got, really.
That's true, yeah.
That we didn't really know much about.
Yeah, but I mean...
I was going to say, don't you remember from Prisoner of Azkaban where when Hagrid was given the post of Care of Magical Creatures professor and Dumbledore was sort of giving his speech and he said that Professor Kettleburn had left to enjoy his time with his remaining limbs?
Oh, yeah. That's true, yeah.
And so I thought this was kind of cool because, like, it gave us background about that. And...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's very true, yeah. Yeah, that's good.
And, like I mentioned earlier, this is a story where Dumbledore explains why Malfoy originally started, the feud between the two.
Yeah.
Yep.
I love how he said that Mr. Malfoy kept writing back to him and he just ignored him.
Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah.
I said what I'm saying and...
You know, and his hygiene as well.
Yeah. That was really funny.
Sanity, heritage, and hygiene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The relevance to this commentary is remote.
It's just all humor. I mean, if you look at it, really, the whole pantomime thing, it's a pretty comical scene. And then everything with Lucius, too. You know, he talks about Lucius trying to get him removed. And then he said, well, it marked the beginning of me trying to get him removed as Voldemort's favorite Death Eater.
I still think,
I like to think he wrote this. Tell me if I'm wrong. After he decided to die, because I think the paragraph that starts this exchange marked the beginning of Mr. Malfoy's long campaign and ends with an end of mind to have him removed from his position as Lord Voldemort's favourite Death Eater is not something that Dumbledore would write if, like, when, you know, he wasn't sure of stuff and things that were going on, because I don't think that's quite an accusation, you know, even though most people know.
Well, he always knew that Malfoy was a big supporter of Malfoy.
Yeah, that is Voldemort.
Yeah, that guy.
That nasty man.
Yeah.
But again, we also do have to remember that these are his personal notes.
They're such a weird concept, though, because they're written, like, completely to be published, obviously.
Right, so it sort of doesn't make sense, in a way. Mm-hmm. But I think that was just...
Just enjoy it. I mean, it's a book.
Just go with it. Yeah, don't analyze it.
Stop.
All right, then we can stop recording, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Was after 170 episodes, Andrew says, don't analyze.
anything else in this story we should talk about?
I'm pretty done.
I think that was it, yeah.
So good book, good read.
The Warlock's Harry Hart. This was a really clever one, I thought.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say, this is where the tales really start to turn dark.
It was This was very brutal for something in a Harry Potter novel.
Yeah, very tragic. It's the most tragic of, I think, all the stories.
It really is tragic. Yeah, it is.
And basically, a quick summary: the warlock has a Harry Hart. He takes him out of himself. Then he meets this chick who's she's the one who's like put the heart back in. So you can feel true love, right? Or something like that.
Man, that was the best summary I've ever
heard. I've forgotten.
He met some chick, and like chick. She was like, dude, put your heart back in, man.
If you think about it, the way we've just been describing it, it sounds like the summary of every single romantic comedy.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
A guy doesn't want to fall in love, so he takes his heart out. And it's up to a woman to bring the heart back into him.
And then they kiss.
And then he cuts open her heart and his, and then they die.
Or eat it.
Yeah, eat the heart. Yeah.
That'd be an awesome end to this.
Yeah.
Bring what? Hannibal Lecter.
It was... Yeah. I don't even know how to go on. But.
I thought this one was the best, to be honest. Like, it just said everything in like a few pages. You know, how, like, the words she used as well, the fact that she deliberately said warlock, and the fact that how she described him, you know, like, she, you know, like, he was up to the top of his place, like, he could only go down. There was no other way. He couldn't get anything more. Like, it was going to end in tragedy right from the beginning, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was totally heartless. In both in literal and figurative sense during the entire story. I didn't really realize that he literally used dark magic to take out his heart. But
yeah, and I sort of like the connection Dumbledore made between that and the Horcruxes.
Yeah, that was
That was nice. Well, do you think the connection has any connection to how the heart pretty much disconnected itself from the body and became like its own?
Definitely,
It's sort of and it took over
when the two figures of Ron and of Harry and Hermione came out of the Horcrux and spoke to Ron. I thought, like, you know, it took over and sort of fed on your worst nightmares and stuff.
Well, what would happen though if you took a Horcrux and you took the spirit back into yourself?
Can you do that?
I don't know. Can you do that? Ever discussed?
I don't know. Discussed.
Saying you can't put a piece of you back inside you?
You can split it, but does that mean it's permanently split? You can't take it back from you?
I kind of remember reading that somewhere, discussing that.
Because wouldn't something like this happen then? Or is it just not possible?
Well, I think it's...
Yeah. He says it's impossible. It could only happen in fiction, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, not to mention the moral of this story was that if you take your heart out, I mean, this was the real moral, but you learned from the story that if you take your heart out and put it back, it'll be too late. I mean, the heart is already...
Yeah. It's
has a mind of its own.
It's a warning. Like, the other ones are kind of like, you know, lessons, but this is more of a warning.
Yeah. But it's also from, like, dark magic, too, that's controlling the heart.
Right.
It was a bit Pirates of the Caribbean.
I know. I thought of that as well. I didn't want to be the one to say it, though.
There's a lot of footnote action going on in this story, too.
Oh,
in Dumbledore's notes.
Well, the main thing he said, though, was that it speaks to the dark depths in all of us, and that's kind of why it survived and was pretty much unchanged over the years. What do you guys think? Do you think stories like that, that have these gory, evil, disgusting, nasty scenes in them generally survive? I mean, we like them, we just don't like to admit that we like them?
It's true, yeah.
Yeah, well, this is definitely one of those stories where they would definitely turn it into a cute, happy-ending Disney film.
Yeah.
Because this reminds me of, like, The Little Mermaid. Like, The Little Mermaid, sacrificed herself for the person that she loved, and now it turned into, like, her father magically gave her legs, and she married the prince, and everything lived happily ever after.
Hey, hell yeah. Well, he's got unlimited abilities if he can just grant people legs.
This is definitely one of those, middle-aged classic fairy tales that constantly get redone.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Toy Story, where toys go out on there, and, like, Buzz goes out on his own and realizes he's not a toy.
Kind of, but not. But,
So good.
The footnotes? Yeah, I was going to talk about the pictures, but are we still on the footnotes?
No.
Gruesome.
I love this photo. I think it's one of my favorite pictures in the entire book. It's just so graphic.
The one where they're both laying there dead.
Yeah, they're both laying there dead with their chest split open and two
really
hearts waiting.
Matt, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, look, I thought, I see the little hairy heart, but the big heart, I mean, it looks like a rotisserie chicken.
it really does.
Yeah. Kind of looks like Snape or Sirius, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like a young Snape.
Yeah, it kind of does.
An elf.
And the girl kind of looks like a...
She doesn't look like anything.
She doesn't look very well, does she?
She looks like the girl from The Ring.
Yeah, she doesn't look like she was described in the book. You know, you're expecting
Someone had just cut her heart out. I don't know how you look after someone does that to you.
No, her face wouldn't change. I mean,
she's got a long neck, too.
Yeah, she does.
Joe's still working on her sketches of women.
she drew the guy really nicely, though. I mean, you can see all the wrinkles and disfigurements in his face.
Yeah.
He's got jeans on.
The visuals in this story are, like, really disturbing.
Yeah, they are.
like the whole part where it's, like, he was, like, licking the heart.
Yeah, that was gross. That was, like,
disgusting.
We have this interesting email about the warlock Harry. Warlock's Harry Hart. It says, "Hi, MuggleCast. This is from Rachel H. I love the story, but Dumbledore's commentary left me a bit confused. On page 57 of the U.S. edition, Dumbledore leaves a footnote regarding the search for a true love potion. He says, Hector Dagworth Granger, founder of the most extraordinary society of potioneers, explains, quote, powerful infatuations can be induced by the skillful potioneer, but never yet has anyone managed to create the truly unbreakable, eternal, unconditional attachment that alone can be called love." End quote. Rachel says, okay, so maybe I didn't want to have I didn't have to write all that, but my point is Hermione's a muggle-born. Is Joe hinting that she gets her magical talent from a wizard in her distant family? I doubt the Granger is just a coincidence.
Yeah, this was solved in book 6. Then she asked if, like, didn't Slughorn ask if she was related to Hector Dagwood Granger? And
she did.
That's true, she did.
Yeah, and then...
Good memory. Jeez.
And then Harry's just like, no, she's like, no, sir. And then he's like, oh, did you really tell him I was the best witch in the year? Oh, Harry.
Good memory, Jamie.
He read
the books.
If for any reason the relation, like, was valid, earlier in Beale the Bard, when Dumbledore was talking about Squibs and Muggleborns in one of his little commentaries, he said something about how most of the time Muggleborn witches and wizards do come about because of a magical relative further back in their family tree.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Well,
but I'm sure it's a common last name, I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's still an interesting connection, especially the quote that Dumbledore uses.
Yeah, but that's really impressive, Jamie. I don't know how the hell you remember that. Yeah.
Thanks. Well done.
Micah, you want to do that last night there?
Yeah, it's just more of the humor of Dumbledore. And he goes back to talking about Beatrix Bloxham and how in her notes somewhere she wrote that she had overheard this story. But that at the same time, she had also overheard something about her Uncle Nobby, the local hag, and a sack of bouncing bulbs. So, I just think that's Dumbledore's way to lighten the mood on such a serious story. It seems like this is a story that you would try and overhear, you know, your parents telling to maybe your older siblings, because you'd always want to know about it. It seems like a story that maybe your older siblings would try to tell you to scare you or you know, something like that.
No, I was just going to refer to Adalbert Waffling's Fundamental Laws of Magic, which I thought was an awesome thing, because, like, it brings magic down to a non-magical level and says that it's not, like, it can't do anything, which is, like, kind of a moral for the entire Harry Potter series, that, you know, like in Book 7 when the Prime Minister is talking to the Minister of Magic and he's like, but you can do magic, and the minister's like, yeah, but the other side can do it as well, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's just, I thought that was a really awesome touch. They said, tamper with the deepest mystery is the source of life, the essence of self, only if prepared for consequences of the most extreme and dangerous kind, which is obviously, you know, Horcrux and Voldemort and everything like that.
Yeah.
There were a lot of, like, books that were referred to in this story from Dumbledore's notes.
Yeah.
Like Albert Waffling's Fundamental Laws of Magic. What was the other book that you mentioned?
Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah, The Fantastic Beasts, I guess.
Is Joe doing, like, a little plug for her own book?
Well, yeah, that's what I thought.
See, this one I like the most. The self-help book, The Harry Hart, A Guide to Wizards Who Won't Commit.
Yeah.
I would buy that.
And the Harry Snout Human Heart was so
Well, it's, yeah, not Harry Snout Human Heart. That was funny.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. But... And the other funny piece that was in here was when he was talking about his aunt, Honoria, calling off her engagement because her suitor had a hairy heart. And I think that was, again, you know, an attempt to explain to us what exactly a hairy heart was.
Yeah.
Kind of similar to the pantomime thing. I don't know if it's a more common expression in other places than others, but then Dumbledore adds in that he doesn't believe that was the reason the engagement was broke off. It was because he was fondling some horcrux. And, you know, this made me think that this book, though, really, while it's supposed to be about a bunch of fairy tales, it really appeals to more of an adult audience, just with some of the things that are discussed.
Yeah. It's very difficult to see why anyone would want to fondle them, because they're like bristly little mushroom-like creatures. Like, like hamsters.
Yeah.
But don't you think, though, I mean, there's a lot of insinuation going on with, you know, her uncle and the local hag and a sack of bouncing bulbs and then fondling some hork lumps. And there are other things throughout the course of this book, though, that are just kind of perverted in a way.
It's true.
No?
Yeah, Jo's letting out now.
She is.
Harry Potter's over. I mean, she doesn't have to, you know.
She can do whatever she wants.
She can write all these gruesome scenes and call people, what were those insults in the beginning?
Scumsuckers.
That was nice.
Yeah. Dung liquor. That's my favorite. Dung liquor. That's kind of pretty brutal. All right, so second to last story, Babbity Rabbity and Her Cackling Stump.
On that theme of, you know,
Adult
audience titles.
Yeah.
Cackling Stump.
Yeah. The most real of Beatles tales, Micah wanted to note. How about a summary of this one? Go ahead, Matt. You do it, since I can't.
This is my least favorite one.
Oh, okay.
This is my least favorite one as well, Matt.
Yeah.
Yeah, mine too.
I personally didn't like it because I got my hopes up the most, I think, for this story.
Well, this one also is the only story that mentions the whole witch hunters thing, too, about it. Like, because the king had witch hunters with hounds going after all the witches, because he also wanted to do magic too. So the king called out asking for any witch or wizard to be his advisor.
I was going to say, it kind of echoes today that people say that people are scared of what they want and they like repress stuff and then like sort of punish people who do what they
want to do. Yeah, they're exactly. Jealous, yeah. sort of the abilities that other people can do, and so in order for them to feel better about themselves, they make it into an evil
when they're scared of it but wish they could do it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's kind of like that. And
so basically, this guy saw this as a potential of making money, and so he calls himself a sorcerer to the king and tells him he'll teach him how to do magic, an instructor for magic. And the king, who isn't very smart, kind of an idiot. Let's face it, this king isn't very smart.
Yeah.
So the king hires him as his sorcerer, and during which the king is doing all these stupid things that the sorcerers, or what is the guy called? A charlatan. And the charlatans teach him how to do all the stupid little nonsense spells and things. And this woman, the washerwoman, called Babbity Rabbity, which is kind of a weird name. It doesn't really fit in with the story, but this old woman's just watching and laughing at him. And I guess the charlatan follows Babbity Rabbity and finds out that she actually is a witch. And so he tries to blackmail her, which foolishly... into being with him during his little show that he's going to put on with the king for showing magic. And the king is starting to get like a little embarrassed about the whole thing. And he tells the charlatan, I'm going to do a show for everybody. And if I get laughed at, I'm going to cut your head off, basically. And you guys want to go on with this story? Because I only read this once.
Kind of a long summary, but basically... The moral of the story is that, what ends up happening is that the king really can't produce magic, and Babbity Rabbity runs off after the charlatan calls her out, and then what happens?
Well, it's like evil doesn't pay as well. Like,
right.
You can't do that to someone and expect it to be a fair game. You know?
Yeah.
It's also, you shouldn't really covet something that you can't get logically or like fairly because, you know, something bad is going to happen to you.
Yeah.
So.
I thought the whole idea of Babbity Rabbity doing the magic behind the bushes was kind of clever.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
I thought that was interesting because I didn't know how she was going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It was, came as a pleasant surprise, I thought.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, though.
I thought the ending was
funny. Yeah, well, the interesting part was being that when she couldn't do anything when he tried to raise the dead boarhound back from life, or the search hound. You know, and that obviously has stronger ties to a lot of what goes on in the Harry Potter series in terms of, you know, you learn that you can never bring anybody back from the dead. Even magic can't do that.
Right.
And, yeah, the ending was funny, though, Laura.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, it was a weird tale, I thought. Like,
it was.
The morals weren't quite as clear as sort of in the other ones. I can't remember. I read a review online, and it compared one of the stories to The Emperor's New Groove. I don't know which one, because I haven't seen The Emperor's New Groove, but
I love it.
Might have been this one.
What's the comparison? I love that movie.
Just that they were based on the same theme and like storytale like thing. But I don't know if it was this one. I'll have to recheck it.
Yeah, I don't know. Sort of. Because there is... I don't know. I'm not sure.
If anyone has any thoughts on that.
Great movie, though. Yeah. anything else you want to talk about here? I guess we didn't even go through the notes. Go ahead, Micah.
In terms of it being the most real of the tales, I mean, it's just the most practical in terms of what we know of the magical world.
Yes,
and Dumbledore brings that up. He says, of all the stories so far, this is one that could have actually taken place given everything that goes on in the story.
Yeah. Maybe this is just like a rejected plot line from J.K. Rowling.
Yeah.
She put in here.
Could be.
Yeah. And I remember
she didn't use it.
Elisa said she was particularly looking forward to this story because Joe had said that she came up with these titles before writing the story, so you know she had to make the story go with the title. So that must have been quite the challenge.
Oh yeah, she said something about that too. Like she said, you try writing a story to go with the title "Babbity Rabbity and Her Cackling Stump"
right.
or something
yeah.
like that.
It must be hard. Mm-hmm. My original thing with it was just that. There was Babbity Rabbity and also the Cackling Stump, not, you know, she would be the Cackling Stump.
But she wasn't the Cackling Stump.
But she wasn't the Cackling Stump.
She was underneath
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
right.
But the stump wasn't cackling, was it?
No. I was
right.
She
no.
would be some type of appendage of her.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Than...
Yeah. So I thought this stump would come to life, literally. And, you know, because if a pot can walk with a foot, why can't it cackle?
Yeah.
It definitely was one of the more anti-Muggle stories, too, saying that wizards are more smarter than Muggles are.
Yeah.
Yep.
Then there's also the first mention of an animagus, which was interesting.
It also talks about how this didn't really go with animaguses, too.
Yeah.
How they cannot speak.
How they differ from, transfigured animals. Which is really interesting because I don't know. I just really like insights into how magic works on a theoretical level.
And seeing this really ancient use of it, sort of.
Yep. And then Dumbledore also mentions that the witch, was it the witch that could have threatened to use the Cruciatus curse on the king because it wasn't yet illegal? And then we kind of get some insight into the... into the Ministry of Magic, in that they didn't make those three curses unforgivable until a certain year, I think it was, right?
1717, I think.
Yeah.
16.
And then we just get more of Dumbledore's humor. I mean, the little, well, it's actually by J.K. Rowling, the bit that's on Professor McGonagall.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah.
I thought that was it was really refreshing to hear, you know, headmistress of Hogwarts, Professor McGonagall.
Right.
And also makes you kind of yearn to hear stories of Hogwarts and Professor McGonagall leading it.
I loved how how he wrote that she asked him to make it quite clear that she became an Animagus purely because of her research in Transfiguration.
Yeah. That she never turned into a tabby cat for any surreptitious purpose.
Yeah.
And
I wonder if Dumbledore ever joked about that with McGonagall.
I bet he teased it.
Yeah, I bet he did.
Yeah. I didn't get the whole rabbit advisor thing to Henry VI. Was that an inside joke, or is that like a British joke, or?
Well, I guess he's supposed to be. I don't really know much about British.
Well, I mean, he
British history.
He was fairly. I mean, I don't know a lot about him, but he was well known to be a complete psychopath. And I think he actually had some mental issues.
Well, wasn't that because inbreeding?
Yeah.
Didn't they say it was because of his family inbred?
So that makes sense.
So, I don't know. He might have had syphilis or something, but
why am I laughing? I'm sorry. Yeah.
That genuinely causes mental problems.
I thought it was just like a misconception,
like a rash.
Yeah. It doesn't actually affect.
I'd always heard that it did, though. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Why do you know so much about this?
Yeah.
She's smart.
I don't.
You'd be re.
But, I don't know, but I just. It's like a joke at that.
Yeah, maybe it was.
You know?
Should we move on to the next one?
Yeah.
Please.
The Last Tale, The Tale of the Three Brothers. This was the shortest, I think.
Yeah.
It was only, what, 3 pages or something?
It didn't really come as a surprise after book 7.
Well, I mean, Jamie and I were talking about this earlier today, but when we read it, we felt like we read this entirety in book 7.
Yeah.
Like, almost.
Yeah, I felt like I knew it all.
What? Yeah. Was the whole thing in book 7?
I swear it was.
Or, like, it was told almost exactly like it was written.
Exactly like it was,
And so Death took the second brother for his own, but though Death searched for the third brother for many years. Yeah, that was
the very last paragraph is definitely written word for word from
book
7. Hang on. I have Deathly Hallows on my computer. We're going to find out about this.
Well, I hope you talk about yourself, Lawrence.
I know.
Well.
Well, while she's looking up that, we'll look at the notes here.
Basically, we don't really need to summarize this tale because everyone's read it.
Everyone knows
it. Yeah. It was Dumbledore's favorite bedtime story.
Yeah.
You know, I really...
Unfortunately, it wasn't Aberforth's favorite book.
I really did enjoy reading this story again because after discussing it so much, you know, here on the show, I found it really just, I don't know, really nice to read again.
It really was, yeah.
All was very clear at that point.
It does have the best moral.
When you originally read The Tale of the Three Brothers, you didn't know everything. And reading it again, because I never reread book 7. Should have, shamefully.
That is pretty cool. Yeah. This is also the most mature moral, too, out of all. I mean, this seems like it's more directed towards adults.
Yeah, I was just about to say about that, yeah.
You never reread Deathly Hallows?
No. Oh, except for chapter by chapter. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You're so funny. But you know what I mean.
The whole thing is in here. By the way,
Joe ripped us off. Damn it!
Yeah, it's actually this is actually Hermione's telling of the tale.
Yeah, it's her interpretation.
Huh? Oh, right. Yeah, because she translated it.
Yeah. Wow. Funnily, she translated it exactly as Joe wrote it.
What are the chances of that?
Wow.
But
I agree, Matt. I thought it was really adult, like morals. It was like it talks to people as adults and says what's going to come and how you can't live your adult life like your childhood life. You know.
Also, it's also more of a moral that a lot of adult men tend to try to cheat because you know, like men have like those midlife crises where they don't want to grow old or
and they buy
age.
A Lamborghini,
or Ferraris or stuff,
yeah,
or a new wife. I don't necessarily buy a new wife. They can go find one. I mean,
however, with the advent of the internet, you know.
Yeah. Oh, jeez.
These things change.
Email ordered brides.
Mikey, get off your computer.
Ordered brides.
What else, Mikey?
Does this story say, sorry.
No, go.
Oh, I was just going to Has anyone read Canterbury Tales?
No.
Oh, no, I haven't.
Oh, okay. You guys suck.
Is this like the Canterbury Tales?
It's kind of... Because Canterbury Tales is several, like, different tales. But it kind of reminded me of the Pardoner's Tale from that, because in that story, there are and they're sort of drunkenly walking along this path, and they're trying to find Death because Death has killed one of their friends, and they want to kill Death. So they run into this old man who tells them that he's left Death in a grove under a tree. So the three brothers go there, and they find all this gold, and essentially they all become really greedy and end up killing each other so that they can have the gold. But like in that way, they...
It
kind of reminded me of this. Yeah.
Stuff like that doesn't happen when I get drunk.
No, no,
but it just seemed like this was sort of loosely based on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
I found it kind of funny, though, in the picture that Joe drew about the three brothers and Death, is that when they made that bridge, Death got angry with them because they cheated Death. But this river is not very big. And
you could just jump
across it. I mean, it's not really that hard. And there's a tree right there, so they can just cut it down.
Well, maybe for book reasons.
What? Maybe. I don't
there just
know.
Wasn't enough room.
I just thought it was funny.
Maybe people couldn't swim back back then.
Maybe people could what?
Maybe people couldn't swim back then.
Who did invent swimming? Did people just keep drowning until one person picked it up?
Steve, people keep drowning until there's so many bodies they just walk over and cross.
Steve Wimmer invented swimming.
Oh, I see.
S. Wimmer swimming.
I think you're being serious there.
No. What else, Micah?
Well, you mentioned it's Dumbledore's favorite bedtime story.
Yeah, I
thought that was kind of interesting, knowing that everything that we learn about him in Deathly Hallows, that, you know, he would like a story like this, and he eventually goes after the Hallows himself.
Yeah, it shows they had an early weakness for this kind of thing, the Elder Wand. Like, I think that would probably be the reason why he loved that story so much, is the fact that there was this really powerful wand.
Also, the mentioning of the Philosopher's Stone, as Michael wrote here, inspiring the Beetle Tale. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it really is. All right, well, I was going to say, in the notes, his final line. He says that even I, Albus Dumbledore, would find it easiest to refuse the invisibility cloak. Journey goes to show you that, clever as I am, I remain just as big a fool as anyone else. That, for me, kind of forgave him for everything he's ever done, because, like, he's very humble.
Yeah,
like, he's not modest, but he's humble. Like, and, like, he admits he's clever, but he also admits he's a fool, and, like, that's what clever people don't really do. So I think he's an awesome character. Like, we met someone at the podcast where I spoke to him briefly, who said she didn't ever forgive Dumbledore for what he did. But I think this is probably going to...
Was that Jess?
No.
But yeah, I don't know.
Again, there was something about these notes as a whole I thought were really meaningful to Dumbledore's life, especially that last sentence.
Well, it's definitely the most notes he's given for a story out of the entire book.
Yeah.
And he definitely has a lot to say about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like,
also, just how he's talking about an Elder Wand and how it's, you know, what was it looking at here?
Well,
the so-called history of the Elder Wands.
Does it ever say why Beetle knows all this stuff to be true? Like,
no.
How did he know this story? And... I mean, we know for a fact that these items do exist in the series.
Well, I think they kind of determined in the book that the story itself wasn't necessarily true, that it was sort of made up to explain where these things came from.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. It almost seems like a plan, though, like Dumbledore's planning in this particular commentary. Like, when he's going through the history of the Elder Wand, it's almost like he's recounting it to himself so he can act,
it's true,
you know,
in
the next couple of months.
It's a reminder as well. Like, this story in the seventh book is kind of, you know, telling Harry to keep his heart head, like, on his shoulders, you know, and stop, like, just rushing forward into things. Like, I think it served a dual purpose to tell him about the Hallows, but also, like, not only that the invisibility cloak is the best option, but, like, that, you know, you need to think about stuff before you, you know, just rush into it.
Yeah. And this was, it was really interesting also to me because it was a sort of foreshadowing his mistakes and the weaknesses he had when he was trying to, you know, help Harry through all this. And, you know, he admitted his mistakes throughout the books. And I thought this was, this book was particularly meaningful in that. Because, you know, like I said, that last sentence again where he says he's just the biggest fool, big of a fool as anyone else. So. Mm-hmm.
And also, Dumbledore talks about these old superstition phrases. When is wands oak and hers is holly, then to marry would be folly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but my favorite like, one... Oh, sorry, what?
They're almost like nursery rhymes.
Yeah. Kind of. Just like old old tale... Oh, I mean, old woman rhymes, or what are they called? Old wives' tales.
Old wives' tales.
Yeah. And wand of elder never prosper, he says. I think that's like the a really good saying because if you think about the elder wand, people with that never really live very long, wand of elder never prosper.
Yeah. Yep.
That's pretty good.
Anything else important to bring up about this? We'll move along. We're getting kind of late into the show here.
Grumble the
grubby goat. Dumbledore's familiar with Alexander Pope.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah,
that was cool. Another Dan Brown reference for those who have read the Da Vinci Code.
Micah, we discussed Grumble the Goat. You're going to write the tale now?
Yeah. That'd be a cool contest, actually, to write that tale.
Yeah.
You can read Raz.
A couple listener feedback about the book, and then we'll wrap it up for today. Camille14 of San Diego, she wrote, as always, love the show and keep up the great work. I was wondering, do you guys think Beetle the Bard will become an audiobook narrated by Jim Dale? We've said he's good enough to narrate a dictionary and make it sound interesting. Will he get the chance to narrate Beetle? If so, it'll be cool to hear the Dumbledore comments in Dumbledore's voice. That would be really cool, but I just don't think...
I don't think it's big enough. Yeah. It's like you can download it or something. Well, I mean, you could for anything, but... I think it'd just be too short. I mean, people like to listen to it on the car or something. It'd have to be a very short drive.
Yeah. Also, some questions from Twitter. I asked people on the MuggleCast Twitter to reply with their questions. And this was fun. We got some good responses. And I like Twitter because people will keep their questions short so they don't send us these books of emails. This comes from Dreysbo, D-R-E-Y-E-S-B-O. If you made a ranking of the Harry Potter series, where would Beetle the Bard stand?
Is it even part of the Harry Potter series?
Well, it's not already comparable. Either.
But, okay, how about between Fantastic Beasts, Quidditch,
Fantastic
Beasts, bad. Then Quidditch.
This is definitely something that you can read and you find more things that connect with the series.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Becca Simpson asks, what was your favorite tale or moral? We sort of talked about our tales. Laura, what was your favorite?
I would have to say the Tale of the Three Brothers. It's just because it has such a relation to Book 7 that really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Was there any favorite moral that really sticked out with everyone? Anyone?
I still like the Fountain of Fair Fortune.
Me too.
Wizards.
Yeah.
Warlock's Heart. It was the best.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. Micah?
I'll go with... Babbity Rabbity and her cackling stump. I don't really know the moral there, to be honest, but I like the moral from the first two stories. You know, it's sort of the wizard muggle relations and them actually getting along with each other as opposed to, you know, using their magical power to threaten other people.
Yeah.
But I did like that story, even though most people did not.
Moving along, Angel12319 on Twitter asks, just wanted to know how many of you bought the collector's edition because I plan to buy it and was wondering who else bought it.
Is that the $100 one?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the expensive one.
I didn't buy it. I don't think anyone here did.
That's insane.
No, not...
I don't.
How much of that goes to charity?
A good amount of it.
A lot of it.
I mean, like $3 of this.
What if I had... I was going to say, like, if I had $100, I would buy it.
Yeah. Are you asking for that for Christmas, Laura? Was that it, or just the regular version?
No, just the regular version.
Well, you should ask for the big one for Christmas.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what you do, Laura? Too, you know?
Laura, see if they're going to do an unveiling of the collector's edition somewhere and go and notice if behind it there's something wrong with the poster or the stand that it's on, and then write to them and say, hey, I noticed this was wrong, and see if they'll send you a free collector's edition.
There we go.
Alice Mania on Twitter asks, why didn't Joe write Grumble the Grubby Goat? After it was mentioned, I wanted to read it, but was disappointed it was left out. Maybe it's for Beetle the Bard too.
Yeah.
It would kind of be cool to see Beetle the Bard too.
Yeah, that mentioned, that's what made me upset, because there's all these other Beetle the Bard stories that were never written.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I have one last point to make that I remember thinking about when I read it. When in the tale of the three brothers, when she writes, yet she was silent and cold, separated from him as though by a veil.
I thought it was
Yeah,
that was really cool.
I thought that was brilliant. Yeah. Obviously on purpose as well.
Yeah. Kathleen91 asks, hey guys, I was just wondering if you thought the tale of the three brothers would be longer. I was excited to read it, but it's 2 pages. What can you do? She had to keep it short for book 7. So.
Well, I mean, it's a good story. I mean, you don't want to drag it out.
It was literally taken word by word from Hermione's telling of it in the book.
So, and they had to keep it short in the book. And I think there wasn't any part that felt rushed or anything. It was just a nice little tale.
It was, the story was already told in the book. I mean, it was the entire story they said. So. Yeah.
Plus, you got the most commentary from it, too.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, come on, Kathleen. Jeez. No, just kidding. And lastly, KJ Potter 94 writes, how long did it take you all to read the book? It took me about an hour and a half.
About an hour and a bit, yeah.
Yeah.
It took me actually longer because I kept rereading it over and over again.
Oh. Laura, Micah?
I would say around an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little over an hour.
I guess I'm
taking
slow.
Notes. No.
Well, Andrew, do you...
Yeah, you're slow.
Do you remember when we were reading Deathly Hallows?
And we were like...
And we were consistently 50 pages apart, no matter what we did.
Yeah. I'm trying to come up with a scheme to, like, distract Laura, to slow her down so I could get by her, but... Never worked out. Should have set your hair on fire or something.
Yeah.
You're
welcome.
I love you too.
Distract everyone, to be honest.
Just wanted to distract
everyone. Just punch her out unconscious.
Yeah.
Wow.
Bitch. It's okay. Hey. J.K. Rowling said it.
That's true. We can say none too.
My book, you bitch.
We can say dung liquor too, because J.K. Rowling said it.
We weren't allowed to say that before.
I never knew that word existed.
Okay, so quick movie talk.
No. All right. Well, this wraps up our Beetle the Bard talk. It's been a long show. I think much longer than we anticipated.
We didn't even intro, Andrew.
No, we didn't. We'll outro. So now you want to do that. Hopefully everyone enjoyed the book, and we'll discuss it on another future episode. Just want to say that I think our next episode will be our Year in Review show, which should be fun. I started working on MuggleNet's Year in Review last night, and realized there was a lot of big stories this year. The movie split, the movie delay,
no movie,
Beetle the Bard, no movie. So, and of course the JKR RDR trial. So, it's a lot of fun stuff to talk about on that episode. And so that'll be out by the end of the month, if not, probably in like 2 weeks or so.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm Andrew Sims.
I'm Jamie Lawrence.
I'm Laura Thompson.
Why'd you point to me?
I pointed to Jamie.
And then you pointed to me.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
And then I pulled my hand away.
You're like... that was the longest pulling of your...
It doesn't matter.
Who cares? It doesn't matter.
Okay, let's just go again.
Let me see some blooper. I'm Andrew Sims.
I'm Jamie Lloyd.
I'm Laura Thompson.
I'm Micah Tannenbaum.
And I'm Matthew Britton.
Thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you next time for episode 166.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.